Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Project Elected podcast. We are so excited to have you, and I'm very excited to talk to our guest today. I've been trying to schedule her for a long time. Her name is Margaret Woolley Bussey, and she is the Executive Director of the Utah Department of Commerce. She has this wealth of experience, so many different things that she's been involved in, and I got to talk to her a little bit before this, and I'm really stoked to be able to talk to her more and learn more about her story. So Margaret, would you introduce yourself to us and tell us a little bit about your current position?
Yeah, thank you. It's great to be on here. And I just love the work that Project Elect is doing and will certainly do in the future. It's such a great cause. So thank you for having me, Audrey. So I am a Utah resident now. I was raised in Utah, but I spent 23 years on the East Coast in DC and mostly in Boston, the Boston area. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But I'm married. I have 5 children. My kids range from 19 to 9. My oldest, so I have 4 teenagers and one that's not teenage yet. But my oldest was a freshman at the University of Chicago, but she just stepped on a mission. She's in the Mexico City Missionary Training Center right now, and will be heading to San Jose, California, which is maybe close to where you are, Audrey. Not quite the same mission, but a little south of there. And so that's really exciting for our family. And so those are my kids, my husband. Sometimes we tease him and call him a rocket scientist. He has a PhD in aerospace engineering, so that is technically what he is, although he works in for an AI startup right now. And he's just a great guy. So feel really lucky to be married to him. And I just, education-wise, I went to Brigham Young University and studied economics, and then I did a joint degree in, or a joint MA-BA in public policy, and then later decided to go get an MBA and did that at Harvard, which is what brought me to Boston. And so that's a little bit about me. And then right now, my current role as the executive director of the Utah Department of Commerce is that I run this agency, and I run it on behalf of the governor, who is Spencer Cox right now, Governor Cox in Utah. And as part of my role, I also serve as a cabinet member. And so it's kind of an interesting dual role, because on the one hand, I'm running an agency. And so I'm doing a lot of, you know, sort of leadership management type activities. But I also, because I'm in this cabinet role, I serve, first of all, I serve at his will and pleasure. I'm also trying to implement his policies and how those would play out in our Department of Commerce, but also serve it as an advisor and on a team of advisors for him. And so it's an interesting role in sort of this doing both of those things. And I'm not just running my department in with no input. And so it's a really interesting role, but it's been fantastic.
So could you tell us a little bit about the Department of Commerce and what it does for those who are not familiar?
Yeah, and I would imagine many people are not familiar with it. So the Department of Commerce is really Utah's chief business and economic regulator. And growing up in a family of entrepreneurs and business people, the idea that I am now a regulator is just a little bit anathema to our family's culture. But it's actually been great, and I've learned a ton. So we do most of the professional licensing in the state of Utah. So if you're a doctor, a contractor, a real estate agent, we have like 70 different categories of licensing. You come through us. We also do all the registrations, corporate and entity registrations. Many times that's in a Secretary of State function. We don't have that in the state of Utah, so it's housed within the Department of Commerce. And we also do all the consumer protection investigations and litigation around that. And that function is typically within an attorney general's purview, but in the state of Utah, it's here at Commerce. And then finally, we're really kind of an economic regulator for public utilities. So public utilities, as many people might know, are natural monopolies, and so they have to be regulated. So that's kind of the purview. It's kind of a broad purview of different things, but really interesting public policy issues all the time.
That is really broad. I didn't realize that you did a lot of the things that Secretary of States usually do in other states, and then some things attorney generals do, as well as just the economic regulation of things. So that's a lot. That's a really broad-based responsibility you've got.
Well, and it's, you know, it's taken me a while to try to get my head around all these things. You know, I came in not knowing a lot about, you know, the details of what the Department of Commerce did. So it's been very interesting. Some people mistake us for kind of the economic development arm for the state, and which is fair because we are the Department of Commerce, but that's not what we do. At least we, you know, I like to think of us as part of the economic development piece because, of course, having reasonable, reliable, and relevant regulation is very important to overall economic prosperity, but we don't play the role of economic development per se. There's a different agency. It's here in Utah. It's called the Governor's Office of Economic Opportunity that does that.
Okay. Thanks for explaining that. That's quite the job, and it sounds like a lot of fun and maybe some stress, but also lots of opportunities to do good in the state. So what are some things you've been able to accomplish in this position that you are proud of?
Yeah, thank you. So I am in my second year. I came in with Governor Cox, again, as his appointee. So I started in January of 2021. And one of the things that we got going on right away was looking at how to reduce unnecessary barriers on professional licensing. And we were doing that because actually Governor Cox's very first executive order on his inauguration day was for all of his agencies to look at how to reduce unnecessary barriers to licensing. There are other agencies in the state that do professional licensing, but we do most of it. And so for us, that was a big job. And while we were doing that, realized that what we really need in order to open up more economic opportunity for people to get into professions and to be more responsive to the labor market, we needed a systematic approach for looking at all of our licensing regulations and our statutes that govern those. And so we took this idea to the governor and he loved it. We talked with legislative leadership and other key legislators. And we now have, well, it will start on July 1, but it will at the beginning of the next fiscal year for the state of Utah. But we have a new Office of Licensing Review. And so that was passed during the recent legislative session, which in Utah runs from January through the beginning of March. And we're really excited about it. I think it'll be a landmark office. It's kind of the first in the nation to do something like this. And it will really, again, allow us to be much more responsive, relevant regulators, making sure that, you know, the rules and laws that we have around, you know, what it takes to be a contractor or a cosmetologist or a doctor are not overly restrictive and keeping people out of those professions and are not overly restrictive in the sense that we might have worker shortages. We can't get enough people into professions, say like mental health therapists or something like that. Maybe we need to look at those professions and figure out how to restructure the regulations around them. So we'll have huge workforce implications and we're really excited about that. So that's one thing. We also took a look at the fees. We generate revenue for the state. We don't take revenue from the state because of all the fees that people pay to either register their entity or get a license. But we realized in some areas that they were too high and we needed to lower them. So that was another big push for us to get the legislature to allow us to lower our fees. So we'll be doing that, which is really exciting for fee payers. And then as an organization, what I've tried to do, you know, as I described earlier, we have a very disparate set of things that we do, but there are commonalities amongst the different, we call them divisions here. And I felt like they were kind of operating in silos and had been for a long time. And I felt like we needed to kind of pull everything together under this idea of one commerce and start sort of collaborating more and sharing best practices amongst different functions of the department. So we started down that path and we've changed our mission statement and we've written a strategic plan so we can be more effective, you know, both our operations and from a regulatory standpoint. So lots of cool, fun things. It's been an awesome experience so far and I have a really, really strong team.
That sounds amazing. And you've done a lot in your time there. How long have you been there? I don't think I ask you that.
So 15 months about, no, 16 months. Yeah. So okay. January of 2021 is when I started.
So just over a year. That's a lot to take on in a year. And it sounds like nice, challenging work for you. So that's great.
Well, one of the things you realize when you're operating in really in a political environment is you don't, you know, Governor Cox only has a 4-year term, right? And so we got to get going. You know, there was no time at all to sort of sit and just sort of think about what to do. It's like we had to think quickly and then we had to take action and just move forward. And that's been, it's been fun.
That's so true. And I think people who don't work in politics sometimes forget that you have to move fast in government. I mean, there's all kinds of sayings about how government moves slow, but if you're a political appointee and you only have a 4-year term or maybe an 8-year term, you've got to get stuff done.
Yeah. Yep.
So I'd love to hear about what a typical day for you is for at home and at work. Like what do you do? How does your day go?
Yeah, thank you. I feel like my job is very much an interesting mix every single day of three types of work. One is sort of management and leadership. The next is public policy, thinking deeply about public policy options. And the other is political. I would say the first two are the biggest because I'm not an elected official, but I do have to think about politics because I work for a politician and I operate in the political environment. So a typical day might be, we might be thinking about, how do we get this person to kind of embrace our vision of One Commerce and get them on board to this idea of collaboration? That might be, you know, something that we're thinking about on a particular day. We might also be thinking about, should we be participating in this multi-state suit against, you know, the opioid manufacturers or something like that? Or should we be... how do we ensure that our regulatory policies on anything from health spas to doctors to professional schools, how can they be more fair? How can we update them? We might be thinking about that. And then on a political standpoint, we would be thinking about, well, which stakeholders in the state and which legislators do we need to sort of reach out to for feedback and support on our proposed ideas? So that's just an example of what we might be doing at work. At home, one of the things that I've found is I really need a break from the day. My brain is really tired. When I first was taking home a lot of work and I kind of stopped doing that. Still, obviously, if there's something that's really urgent, I will obviously have to get back, log back in or whatever and get back on the computer and do work. But I try to avoid it because I'm tired, but I also really want to make sure that I am paying attention at home. And so I just come home and it's like my work brain kind of switches off and I am like 100% on my kids, you know. And we have 4 kids in the house now because my first is out of the house now. But they are all at ages where, you know, if you're not paying attention, you're just missing stuff. They don't demand things in the way that small children do, but they need emotional and mental support, and I have to be really present. Otherwise, I'm missing it. So I really do try to turn it off when I get home from work and just be with them. And even in the mornings, I try to really be focused on them as we kind of get them off to school. I know this is an LDS focused podcast. I read my scriptures and I pray every morning, and it used to be that I did those a lot faster without being as thoughtful because I would be in a rush. And I've just realized like, I can't do that. I need to have that space, 15 minutes, you know, where I'm kind of doing that. And so that's really helpful for me as well.
That's great. And I think people love to hear about how women are balancing and figuring out work and life and home and kids, and especially having 5 kids. I mean, that's a lot of kids. And it's teenage years mine aren't teenagers yet. I've got 3. My oldest is 12 and she's right on the cusp. And I can see what you're talking about. Like you need to be present and listening to them and not thinking about work when you get home, which can be hard if you've had a stressful day and you've been got all these things running through your mind. But it sounds like you figured out how to kind of turn that side off and turn the mom side on and be really present for your kids, as well as do your spiritual development, which, you know, I think a lot of people find really centering and helpful.
And I use my weekends that way too. Like I've noticed, like I kind of turn it off. I mean, again, sometimes I have to be doing some things with work, but mostly I try not to, because I need those days to be with my kids. I need my Sabbath desperately to be focused on those things and focus on the fam, on my family. And so I feel like, you know, it's actually really important to be taking breaks away. And then I kind of come back and refreshed on Monday morning. And it's important for the way I function.
Yeah. And I like how you say your brain is tired. I mean, your brain needs some rest after doing the intense things that you've been doing all day, and you'll do better, I'm sure, if you give it a little rest and don't think about that all the time, which can be hard in these days where we're getting email alerts on our phones constantly and it feels like everything's an emergency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep, exactly. And so anyway, I just kind of have figured out over, I think whenever you start a new job, and especially if it's sort of a big intense one, it takes some time to acclimate and sort of figure out how to operate in an optimal way. I don't know that I'm there, but I feel like I'm doing better than I was, you know, the first 6 months of my job, this job.
Yeah, that's great. That's really great. So I want to talk a little bit about what you did before your current position, because just reading through your bio and your profile and your background, you've had so many different experiences, from consulting to being involved in your community when you lived in the Boston area. Tell me a little bit about that and the other things that you've done and kind of what you learned from those.
Yeah, happy to. So what's kind of fun is I work in state government now, but I hadn't ever before, but I'd worked at the federal government level and in local government. So it's kind of fun now I'm in state government. When I first graduated BYU, I went out to DC. I was there for 3 years and I worked for the US Treasury Department, working on financial institutions policy, and then also specifically on community development financial institutions policy. I was really interested in kind of the concept of microfinance, microlending. And that was actually what made me decide to go to business school, because I realized I wanted to get more of the financial understanding of how things operated, and so ended up going. But I was always really interested in kind of social impact and how do you create change for good, you know, in the world, which sounds kind of lofty and maybe a little bit Pollyannish, but that was what I was interested in. And so I decided to go to business school. I went to Harvard Business School. They had a really great program within the school called the Social Enterprise Initiative, which tries to kind of help translate business practices and management practices to the social sector, where people are trying to make social change. And so I loved that, and I had a great experience there. I met my husband while I was attending, and we got married right after I graduated. He was finishing up his PhD, and then I got a job there doing consulting in the social impact space while my husband finished up. And then about 2 years in, I had my first baby. My last day at work was the day I had the baby. I went to work while I was still in labor because it wasn't too bad. And that was supposed to be my last day anyway. And I thought, I got to finish up. So I went in and I sat on a towel just in case my water broke. And then I left, and I thought I might go back, but I didn't go back. And I was at home. I was a stay-at-home mom for 12 years. And we were living in the Boston area that whole time. I had 5 kids during that time. I knew that I wanted to be kind of somehow stay involved in different things, wanted to keep my skills fresh, really loved the town that we were living in, had met so many great people there, and just decided I was going to get involved there. And as many of you probably have experienced, like, there's always a need for people to be involved at the local level, always. And it's such a fun way to be involved and to meet other people and really, like, determine the future of your community. We lived in a town called Acton in Massachusetts, right next to Concord, if you remember your American history. And it was just a really wonderful place for our family to be. And I went in, I said, I want to be involved. And I was put on the planning board and learned a lot about local zoning rules, and then was appointed to be head over this kind of planning effort, kind of looking at what Acton should be over the next 10 years. And so that was a huge effort that, you know, I sort of led a committee, and then we did tons of outreach and community forums and all this stuff. And it was a great experience and I loved it. And then after that was done, I ended up transitioning over to the finance committee, where we were building out the budgets for the town, and got to understand more about municipal finance. And that was fascinating. And also I chaired that committee, and it was an interesting experience because I was with, I think I was the only woman on the 9-member committee, and every other person was, maybe with the exception of one, was about 20 to 30 years older than me. So that was an interesting experience, but it was great. And I loved it. And I loved the people I worked with, and people were really cared about the community that they were in. And it felt good. And it felt good in a way that, you know, politics now doesn't feel that good because we're polarized. But, you know, for me, when I was working in my community, my political party really didn't matter. Even though I was a Republican, and, you know, in Massachusetts, of course, almost everyone's a Democrat. And, but it didn't matter because we were all had this common goal of working to improve our community. So I loved that. I had just a great experience. I spent 8 years doing that, in fact, and, it was great. And then I decided to go back to work, and I actually went back to work at Harvard Business School as the associate director for that social enterprise initiative that I've been involved with as a student. And that gave me a great opportunity to learn, kind of refresh myself on what are all the social issues that are going on? What are the things that are happening? Of course, those are all political issues too. We looked at future of work issues and higher ed reform and impact investing and a bunch of different things. And so it was just another dimension to sort of understanding what's going on in the world around us and what are the big issues. And it was a fantastic experience. I loved it. I feel so grateful to my boss, who just kind of took a chance on me. You know, I was coming back really after not being employed almost at all for 12 years. And it was fantastic. And my husband and family were very supportive. And in the midst of all that, I decided to run for state Senate. And I was kind of horrified by the political polarization that was happening. This was in the 2018 election, and decided I need to stand up and be a different example of what politicians could be. And, you know, I knew I was running an uphill battle. I was running against a longtime Democratic opponent, but I felt really strongly about getting my message out of how we can work together, how we need to, you know, come together around common goals and find those commonalities. I felt like I'd done it in my community. You know, all my friends are Democrats. All the people I work with are Democrats, and we were fine, and we worked really well together. And that message now almost seems quaint because I think we're in a much worse position. But back then it was almost still novel. Like, wow, how did we get so politically polarized? You know, now it's just what everyone knows and expects, unfortunately. I did not win. I ended up running in a year that was the biggest blue wave ever. About 17% increase in turnout. And all of those people were there to vote straight blue because they were really mad about what was going on. But it was a great experience. And one of the things you learn from campaigning, I mean, you learn a lot about campaigns, but you also learn because you talk to so many people. I mean, I knocked on 6,000 doors myself and talk to thousands of people. And when you're doing that, you're learning about how people feel about things. And it kind of cuts through what you otherwise hear from either political leaders or the press or whatever. So I did that. And then we decided to move here in 2019 to be closer to family. And yeah. Met Spencer Cox early on when I first moved here. So impressed with him, helped him in his campaign, and now I'm doing this. So that was kind of a long-winded answer. Sorry.
No, that was amazing. And I have a lot of things that I want to ask you about from what you were talking about. So let me see. I love how you said there's always a need to be involved in local government, because I think that's so true. But maybe could you tell us a little bit more? You said you just went in and said, I want to be involved. Like, how did that go? Because I think a lot of our listeners want to get more involved, but they don't know how to take that first step.
Yeah, I mean, I started just reading our local papers. You know, a lot of those papers, sometimes those papers don't get read. I read them because I just wanted to understand the issues. Also, Massachusetts towns have a very interesting form of government. They have something called town meeting, which anyone that's a citizen, a registered voter, can come and participate in. It's almost like a legislative body, which I won't go too much into, but it's actually a fascinating political process. But because of that, you can immediately be involved, at least in that way. So I started to go to those meetings just to understand the issues. And then I got in contact with one of our elected officials. We have what's called a select board. It's like a town council or a city council, but they're called a select board in Massachusetts. And she was really enthusiastic and, you know, wanted me to be involved. Oh, because she was in my neighborhood and I had planned a block party. And so so we kind of got to know each other through that. And she was just really supportive. And she said, you know, we have a spot on the planning board. We need somebody. And that's how I first got involved. And people knew that I think people probably knew I was Republican, but it was fine. Like, again, it was just this sense that, you know what, we're all Democrats here, but that's fine. We have someone that wants to help and we're not gonna, you know, say no to that. So, but it was an interesting environment because it is very unbalanced there.
Yeah, I lived in Massachusetts for a while and now I live in California, so I know the imbalance. But I mean, that's interesting that they didn't care you were Republican, because I think that might be harder these days. Like you said, things are a little more polarized than they were just four years ago.
But I still believe that at the local level, it is just so much less relevant. Again, because you have common goals. Everyone wants your community to be better. You might disagree on those things, but on how to make it better. But those are largely not along party lines. Those disagreements, they're just not. Now, again, to your point, Audrey, you know, we know that the old adage that all politics is local has been completely flipped on its head, and national politics seems to permeate everything. But I do still think there's a really great opportunity to be effective in local communities and not be caught up in that. Which is great. I think it's great news for everyone that wants to be involved, because many people don't want to be involved because they look at the political polarization right now and they just think, I don't want to partake of that, you know? So.
Yeah, which is one of my issues I'm always harping on, is that you got to get involved if you want to help the political polarization. Yeah. If we just let the extremes run things and nobody who's more moderate or who wants to just engage with the other side, whatever their political views are, it's always going to be polarized like this. So it's kind of a catch 22 that way.
Yeah. No, it is. It's great to be involved. Anyway, go ahead, Audrey.
Oh, I just wanted to ask you, so you were doing this town council and all of that while you were a stay-at-home mom. You weren't working at the same time?
Okay. Most of the time. I probably did about 1 year while I was still working. That was really intense. I knew I needed to kind of step away, because doing work and the town stuff and the family stuff was a lot. But I was finishing some really important initiatives that I had started or, you know, had worked with. And so I stayed on. But yeah, most of that time was stay-at-home mom. And so it was great because my kids were little at the time. They were going to bed early. My husband was home from work and I could just go. I would go to these meetings in the evening, and it worked really well. And it really kept me engaged and helped me to be more prepared for what I'm doing now, really. You know, it was a political process. It was engaged, stakeholder engagement, all of those things. I learned, I cut my teeth in just doing that in Acton, Massachusetts.
Yeah, that's fantastic that you did that and that you took the time to do that when you even had little kids and figured out a way to make it work. I'm sure your community benefited a lot from having you involved. I also want to know, was it hard when you went back and when you decided to go back into the workforce after kind of being out of a paid position? Because it sounds like you were working while you were a stay-at-home mom. It just wasn't paid work. Did you find that transition difficult? A lot of people are worried about, you know, their resumes or gaps in their resume when they took time off to take care of kids. Was that difficult for you, or was it easier than you thought?
I was a little intimidated about it. I didn't know what people would think. Mostly I was worried about an employer sort of saying, oh my gosh, like she has five kids. How can she possibly do it? Not even so much that I had a resume gap, but just how is she going to do that? Now, of course, they're not allowed to ask that. But in my particular situation, I connected into this position with somebody that knew me personally. And so I knew that that employer would know. And if he had a problem with me having five kids, then he wouldn't hire me. But he did. And he allowed a lot of flexibility. And I kind of negotiated that flexibility. And basically the way that we worked it was, I said, instead of doing a 5-day a week job, I want this to be a 4-day a week job. And I want one of those days to be at home. And then my husband agreed to basically do the same thing. So that he was working one day at home, 3 days in the office, but 4 days total. So he stepped back a little bit. And then we kind of split the logistics of family management, you know, all the sports and music and all that kind of in half-ish. And then we were, you know, one of us was home every day except for one day. And it worked. And the kids were in school except for my youngest. And she went over to a neighbor's house for part of that day. And so it was actually, you know, we figured out a way to work, but you know, everyone's circumstances are different in terms of how you make that work, but we made it work. And I will say that the community involvement was very, very important in getting my job. I mean, it was because I had been a student and a graduate of Harvard Business School, going back to work there was good because I had a lot of credibility already, just like having a Harvard Business School degree, right? They liked that because that's the school. But also, you know, my boss that hired me, he said, I see all the things you've done in your community. Like that is real work and that takes skill. And he recognized that as being something that was absolutely legitimate experience. So that's another benefit of community work and volunteer work.
Yeah, that's so good to hear. And that you were able to use that experience to, you know, your future boss knew about it and knew all the things that you'd done and understood it. And so that's great. And also that you were able to negotiate for flexibility, because I think sometimes women are afraid to do that. And especially these days, employers almost expect it that you're going to negotiate for some more flexibility and maybe work from home and maybe work 4 days a week. And that's not a big deal.
Yeah, not at all. And I am a huge advocate for it. We have people, we call them returnees, these returnships that, you know, sometimes that's a term thrown around. And we have them here at the Department of Commerce, and they've just been extraordinary contributors to our work, and they work part time and they're doing really substantive work. And I love it. And it's been a program actually that Lieutenant Governor Deidre Henderson has really promoted. She's really passionate about it. You can get back in, you know, and sometimes it's a confidence thing of just kind of regaining your confidence, but people, you know, still have skills, still have intelligence. You can get back in.
Absolutely. I also just wanted to say, I don't think it's Pollyanna-ish at all to want to do good in the world. I think that's fantastic. And avoiding becoming cynical when you work in politics is, I think, really important. It's very hard, but we want public servants and we want people involved in public service who want to do good instead of promoting themselves. So, you know, I always love to hear that that's why people initially got involved and that's what drew them to it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, you know, if you're involved in politics and you find yourself getting really cynical, get out.
Yeah. Step away.
It's not good for your soul.
No, so definitely not. So what do you think makes a good public servant?
So I think, you know, here's what I admire. Let me start it that way. I admire public servants that are specifically trying to bring people together and aspire, you know, and sort of aspire around like common vision, right? And I think that our politicians, maybe they were disingenuous, but I think that many politicians we've had in the past have actually done that, you know, and maybe there's been a galvanizing force. Maybe there was a war. That's easier in a way to kind of galvanize people around a common vision when you have a common enemy. Now I feel that politicians are typically gaining power by making other people mad, making people mad at the other side. To me, that's really easy. It's not hard to do. So I don't admire those people. I admire the people that actually try to bring people together. You just don't see it as much.
Yeah, I certainly hope we can get back to that more, because you see it in how things just can't get done in Congress and in state governments. You know, it's really hard to get stuff done if you won't even talk to people of the other party or people who don't agree with you, even in your own party, if they don't agree with you on specific issues. And that's really unfortunate. And it's not a way to govern.
Well, and I would say, you know, in many ways, it's unfortunately reflective of ourselves, right? I mean, you know, and I think people have two sides. You know, there's a side of me that does get mad, you know, at things of a quote unquote other side. And that can be exploited for somebody else's political gain. But there's also a side of me that wants to be inspired and wants to feel commonality with my, you know, with my neighbor and not feel like I'm opposing people, right? So there really are two different parts of human nature. And when we as people kind of give in to the one, because our leaders are trying to exploit it, it's probably a sort of an iterative thing. We give in, then they do it, and they do it more and all that kind of stuff. We're all just worse off as a society.
Which I really like how you said that. Thank you for that. Who inspires you politically? Who are your role models?
Yeah, I mean, maybe this sounds, you know, like I'm brown nosing my bosses, but the reality, it really is. I mean, I was so inspired by then Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox when I first met with him, when I first moved out here. And I thought, I want to do anything I can to help him to bring a new model of what good leadership looks like, political leadership looks like. He is somebody that is trying to unite people and is deliberately not trying to exploit people's distrust and hate for on certain things. He is trying to bring people together around common goals. And that's why I think I connected so much with him, because that was what my campaign was all about when I ran in Massachusetts. And I think that's really why I connected with him. And I really admire that. And I see him as someone that is doing that and has tremendous integrity. And, you know, his deputy, Lieutenant Governor Deidre Henderson, is this of the same ilk, and also was doing amazing things to just be an example of women in political leadership here in Utah. We don't have enough of it. And she's just done tremendous, just by her example alone is helpful, but she is actively advocating for more women in politics. And that's not something that she has to do. She's doing it because she believes it, that more women in politics can actually help our country and actually maybe help to moderate some of the excesses that we've been experiencing. And that's not to say that women don't fall prey to any of these other excesses either. I don't think that's true, but I think it can make a difference. And so anyway, I just really admire both of them. I have a hard time coming up with a lot of current politicians that I would say that I admire at the moment, besides those two. And that's why I'm working for them.
Yeah, well, that's great. I mean, it's good to like your boss and admire the person you work for. So I wanted to ask you about, you know, working inside and outside of Utah and being involved in public service, both. How has your faith helped or hindered you in your career, do you think?
Well, I mean, absolutely, by and large, my faith has helped me. I mean, in the sense that feeling personal revelation and direction from Heavenly Father is what has spurred me in everything I've done. And I don't think I would have the confidence to do what I have been doing without having that spiritual direction. So that, you know, is number one for me, and kind of overcomes anything that's possibly negative. I will say, you know, being in an environment in Massachusetts where many of my religious beliefs were absolutely anathema to the kind of culture in Massachusetts was tricky. But it also really helped me to think deeply about how we have to be able to get along with each other even when we disagree, and how we can. And my closest friends from Acton, where I lived for 12 years, I know deeply disagree with me on certain things. But we are friends, and we love and respect each other despite any differences. And I think that was it's very easy to be surrounded by friends and family that agree with you on everything. That's easy. That's what we kind of all do, and we kind of all gravitate towards. But being in Massachusetts, I just didn't have that as much. And so I just learned a different set of skills and learned a lot about just, our common humanity as people here on Earth trying to do our best, even when we have different beliefs. And so I think that, you know, it was a challenge, but it was a great learning opportunity for me. And I have very, very deep feelings for the people for people in Massachusetts that were just different from me.
That's wonderful. I lived in Massachusetts too. And that's part of why I asked that question, because a lot of people haven't even really heard of the church out there, and you can get very mixed responses to it. And I think that's amazing that you were able to make great friends in your town and have mutual respect and love for each other, despite maybe differences of opinion.
Yeah. You know, I mean, on that point, Audrey, one of the things I kind of decided, I decided, our ward, you know, of course in Massachusetts, it was very spread out. It was like 10 towns, you know, mm-hmm. And I just decided, like, I loved people in my ward, and I have very strong friendships with people that were in my ward. But I decided early on that I was not going to have my social life revolve around people in my ward, because I think a lot of times when you're in those environments, you do just kind of cling to people in your ward because everything feels kind of foreign. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to be friends with my neighbors. I wanted to be deeply involved in my community. I wanted to be part of what it meant to be living in Massachusetts. And that's what I did. You know, even when it did sometimes feel a little bit uncomfortable, but ultimately became wonderful. So I think that's important as members of the church, just in general. Like, we sometimes, differences do make us feel uncomfortable. Again, a cliche, but it's true. But we got to get outside of ourselves. We just absolutely have to. And the other thing that you just mentioned, Audrey, I loved being LDS in both DC and Boston, in the Boston area. I loved that I could define it for people, because many people just didn't know much about it. I was actually I had some anxiety about coming back to Utah, because the LDS church is the thing, and you're either with it or you're not with it, or you're opposing it or whatever. And I kind of didn't want that. I just wanted I like to have my faith and not have, you know, all the newspapers talking about it all the time. But there are other awesome things about Utah, and I've loved it.
Yeah, that's great. I grew up in Utah, lived on the East Coast, and now live in California, where it's less like East Coast, where nobody has heard of the church. It's definitely more well known out here, but it's still, you know, you can define it for people, and that's a big responsibility, but it also can be amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So we are just about out of time. I wanted to ask you if you had an invitation for our listeners.
We talked about it before. I invite you to figure out what your next step is to be involved in your community. You know, as Latter-day Saints, we are naturally communitarians. We are. We operate in these ward and stake environments, and we know how to serve. We know how to serve people. We know how to organize. We know how to lead. I mean, I was Relief Society president twice. you know, maybe that was the biggest thing that's prepared me for this job, you know, is running that or running those organizations. You have the skills to be involved, and you have an incredibly important voice that needs to come to your community, and it needs to come now. You know, we are in perilous times. We really are. We all know it. We all feel it. And this is our calling right now, is to be involved. And that can be in a variety of different ways, and it can be very flexible in terms of your time, but be involved, get involved.
Thank you so much for that. That is just speaks to my heart. I loved it. And thank you for taking the time to talk with us today. This has been such a pleasure getting to know you and talking to you and hearing your really thoughtful insights and wisdom, and we appreciate it so much.
Thank you. It's been awesome to be on this this program, Audrey, and I'm again just so grateful for the work that you're doing to galvanize women and LDS women into getting involved in their communities. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to always to talk to amazing women like you and learn more about what you're doing. So thank you, listeners, for tuning in today. We would really appreciate it if you would go on Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star rating. And tune in next time. Thank you.